Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Now look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Adam Kempinar.
And I'm Josh Larson.
The table is set. The festivities have begun. One uninvited guest has arrived. And this year, there will be no leftovers.
Happy Thanksgiving from Eli Roth and all of us here at Film Spotting. Josh, I hope you and your family had a nice turkey day.
Well, we didn't have any butcher knife wielding crazies.
Well, that is a good thing. On this special holiday edition of the show, we start our look back at the year in film with our Golden Brick Preview. We're focusing on the movies we think are overlooked or underseen movies of 2014. That and more.
Happy Thanksgiving.
Was that scary? Ahead on Film Spotting.
This episode of Film Spotting is brought to you by Shutterstock.com. With over 2 million high-quality video clips, Shutterstock helps you take your creative projects to the next level. To get 20% off only footage clips for new accounts, go to Shutterstock.com and use offer code FILM1114.
Listening to Film Spotting. There are plenty of reasons to get out to the movies this Thanksgiving weekend. You've got the latest chapter of The Hunger Games, which opened last weekend. Foxcatcher, the new movie from Moneyball and Capote director Bennett Miller, is open here in Chicago and select cities. We'll review both films on next week's show. This week, though, maybe we'll give you a few reasons to stay home for movie night. It is our Golden Brick Preview. So for listeners who are maybe unfamiliar with this concept, Josh, we
Is
have
it
been doing
time
it.
To get into the mathematical
well,
formula?
I hope not. We're going to make it very brief because I think for maybe the first time ever, we have a pretty set of criteria.
I think we do.
That we can live with. And basically, what we mean by underseen or overlooked is it's not a big Hollywood movie, not a mainstream movie you probably saw trailers for everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
It is a movie that was reviewed on the show by at least one of us. So it had to be a movie that was talked about in some detail. And we do put a premium on emerging filmmakers or new filmmakers. We're not going to pick someone who's made 5 films or 7 or
right.
8 films.
Doesn't have to be a debut. But
exactly.
Somewhere in between.
But maybe one or two, someone who is not that well known. And we are focused on, as we tend to do with all the movies we review, we're interested in directors and filmmakers who show a unique vision, who have a real inventiveness. Sometimes that is in the form of real formal inventiveness, doing something with the camera or editing, but not always. We just want to see that sense of vision and hopefully some artistic ambition. So that is all the Golden Brick really is.
Yeah,
and the good
done.
Part is, Josh, is that even though we've never necessarily had it that well-defined, if you look back at the winners we've had going back to the inaugural Golden Brick winner, it fits for every film we have anointed. 2009, it was Duncan Jones' film Moon. In 2010, it was the Greek film Dogtooth. 2011, the film The Arbor. The listeners chose Take Shelter from Jeff Nichols. In 2012, we went with Wuthering Heights from Andrea Arnold. Our listeners went with Nuri Bilge Ceylan's Once Upon a Time in Anatolia. And last year, really a no-brainer for us, was Joshua Oppenheimer's The Act of Killing.
Yeah, the only one that might stand out among those is Wuthering Heights. But then when you think about the formal nature of the film itself, it does also
very
fit.
Experimental in a lot of ways. So that's why we went with that back in 2012.
We're going to announce the complete short list for this year's candidates later in the show. But let's get started by revisiting the review of our first finalist. It's the quirky revenge thriller Blue Ruin that comes from director Jeremy Saulnier. Now, Saulnier, this was not a director either of us was familiar with beforehand. Blue Ruin, it's actually his second film as a director. He did work as a cinematographer on features going back to 2006. Let's take a listen to our review from May of this year when we were joined by our friend Steve Procopi, a.k.a. Capone from Ain't It Cool News.
You hunt?
No. Target shooting mostly.
mountain biking.
What do you need this for?
I'd rather not.
Oh, no. Hey, no, man. Less I know, the better. What do you need out of the gun? At range? Close quarters? Close up or far away?
Oh, close up, probably. I don't know. Hopefully not at all.
Roger that.
Devin Rattray as an old high school buddy helping out Macon Blair's Dwight, doing a little gun shopping in that clip from Blue Ruin from writer-director Jeremy Saulnier. Saulnier has 10 or so feature credits to his name as a cinematographer and one previous as cinematographer slash writer slash director, 2007's Murder Party, listed on IMDb as a comedy slash drama slash horror movie. And as we'll get to in a minute, it's appropriate that we kept you around, Steve, for this review for a couple of reasons. One, though, being if anybody I know had somehow managed to see Murder Party, it would be you. Yes or no?
I did see it way back when it was fairly new. I had to go look it up to remember it.
Not always a good sign.
It's a decent first film.
Okay.
I think.
Okay. Well, let's see if
he
followed up with something better.
Yeah.
Blue Ruin's Dwight is a beach bum, a homeless one at that. When he learns that the man responsible for killing both of his parents is going to be released from prison, Dwight seeks his vengeance, reigniting a family conflict that puts his life and the lives of others at risk. We wanted to spend a few minutes on this movie as it has been getting some good buzz over the past couple of weeks. It played Sundance after premiering at the 2013 Cannes Film Festival, where it screened in the director's fortnight, earning the International Critics Prize. And last Friday, May 2nd, it screened at the Music Box here in Chicago with a post-screening Q&A featuring Saulnier and moderated by you, Steve. So we're going to start with you. Blue Ruin is a movie, I'd say, clearly shot by an experienced cinematographer. It's not very dialogue heavy. It relies on the starkness and the simplicity of its imagery. And it's a movie clearly made by a director who knows movies and generic tropes, though I do think it'd be inaccurate to reduce it to merely a riff on the revenge thriller. What did you get out of seeing it a second time? And should we take anything more profound away from Blue Ruin or just enjoy how finely crafted it ultimately is?
It is a beautiful film. It's shot around some more rural areas of Maryland and Virginia, which is where Saulnier is from. But for me, it was a wonderful exercise in deconstructing. And I don't know if he'll do this in future films, but I really hope that he does. And this seems to be the way a lot of young directors are approaching things now. They're almost become cliche in terms of the way that they're plotted. In this case, it's a revenge thriller drama. And he's taken the elements of it and pulled them apart and then assembled them in what we would consider the wrong order almost. Because in most of these revenge films, the act of revenge happens at the end. Here it happens a few minutes into the film. And then as things progress and then someone seek revenge upon Dwight, it just gets worse and worse and worse. And it actually gets more complicated the more that is revealed. It's a fascinating character study. It's a fascinating look at consequences that a lot of these kind of films, frankly, don't have. What happens to the guy after he gets his revenge? We don't ever get to see that in most films. Here we do in spades, and it's harrowing stuff, and you don't quite know where it's going to go. There's some truly graphic violence in this mm-hmm. film that comes out of nowhere. Yeah, it's then the performance by the lead actor, Macon Blair, who I've seen in a few TV things, and he was in Murder Party in a much smaller part in a couple of movies, but man, I can't wait to see what he does next.
Yeah, we should talk about the performance because it's interesting how people that I've seen have read that. But when you talk about his character Dwight not knowing if he's going to get out of this situation alive, he hasn't thought about if he's going to, I don't think he's thought about much
No.
of anything.
No.
And that's what's fascinating to me about this deconstruction is that it feels like it's progressing within this genre in a completely different way in terms of suspense, because Saulnier has been able to craft this atmosphere of complete, you have no expectations of how things are going to happen. It's almost as if the whims of life are going to decide if this guy's successful, how he is or isn't successful, if he gets away, what happens when he gets away. Just minor little things will turn this guy's fate. And so I was really kept guessing and wondering every moment. The violence does come out of nowhere as well. Almost everything in this movie comes out
yeah.
of nowhere
yeah.
is how I experienced it. And I really did like that for a twist on the revenge genre, which does seem to follow the same traditional path. And when you talk about him having to deal with these consequences, in a way, it isn't until he becomes somewhat successful in his mission, which happens way later in the film, you could argue, because yes. he's very inept, that he's suddenly face to face with the realization, if I pull this off, what does that mean? Mm-hmm. And you're right that we don't get that part of this whole drama of seeking revenge and what the implications are of that. The performance of Macon Blair really worked for me. He was a guy who seems just pulled off the street. That's how he carries himself. And there is a great transformation when he shaves off that drifter beard and suddenly looks at, you know, a clerk at an Office Max or something. And the violence only gets more horrific from that point on. So there's a nice counterpoint to how that works. But I think it was Sam Van Halgren, our producer, who talked about on Letterboxd about the performance and wondering how this movie might have been elevated to a different level if there was someone with a little more charisma in the part. But Sam also noted that it's clearly intentional to have this everyday guy in the part.
Right, yeah.
And for me, that was one of the strokes of brilliance in the film, is that he did seem like this guy you could run into just about anywhere who's suddenly enmeshed in this horrible story that isn't really played for comedy as much as something maybe like Blood Simple, which is a clear influence. I thought more of Shotgun Stories.
Yeah,
actually,
I was definitely going to go
the Jeff Nichols film
with that,
where this is a more mournful take on the revenge drama.
Yeah, Sam and I actually saw the movie together, and we talked about that afterwards because we loved all the performances in the movie. The whole ensemble is fantastic. You're just perfectly cast, but especially Macon Blair, though Sam did have that little take on him in terms of wondering if almost the film would be elevated to another level with maybe a more dynamic actor.
He's not dynamic. He's not charismatic.
But
that's for sure.
I don't know that I agree with Sam. I'm with you. I mean, I really think he's exactly perfect for this role. And Shotgun Stories is the movie I had in mind a lot. You kind of have to think about it if you've seen that Jeff Nichols movie as you're watching this movie, because they're both about domestic squabbles, two warring families, and a character trying to make right by doing something terribly wrong. And of course, that then just spiraling out of control. I also thought a lot about No Country for Old Men, because he's kind of like, Dwight is kind of like Josh Brolin's Llewellyn Moss character, except there is a point in No Country where I think Brolin actually says, well, he messed with the wrong guy. Like, he thinks he's capable of handling the situation. He was a soldier. There's some allusion to that. He was in Vietnam. So he kind of knows what he's doing. This guy, Dwight, really has no idea at all what he's doing. He really is the wrong guy. And there's a scene that's actually almost lifted straight out of No Country for Old Men, right? Which is the one where Anton Chigurh has a leg injury. I think it's a pretty significant leg injury. And he goes to a pharmacy and he buys all the right equipment, all the medical paraphernalia, and then he goes and fixes himself, right? He bandages himself back up and uses the alcohol and all that stuff. We get that scene here almost verbatim, except it starts to go like Anton Chigurh might be the guy who knows what he's doing.
Or
until,
Rambo or anybody.
Or Rambo,
yeah,
there you
exactly.
go, definitely First Blood. Yeah. Until Dwight all of a sudden almost realizes, wait, I'm not that guy. You know, I am not capable of doing this. And I do love those things. And I think that Saulnier is certainly aware of movie conventions. Moreover, though, I think he's aware that his audience is aware of those conventions, but he isn't just deconstructing them. I don't think it's just about sort of being a provocateur and playing with us. I do think subversion isn't all that he's out for. I think he just uses our recognition to kind of raise the tension, to heighten the suspense, and to get us to focus on the character. There's a real heavy, you mentioned this, Josh, attention to detail about this movie in terms of what the camera focuses on. It's also reflected in the character of Dwight, because we see him right away, and he's this shaggy, terrible-looking homeless character. And we immediately start to make, or at least I did, some assumptions about him and draw some conclusions about what type of person he is. But then what we start to see is he's really pretty fastidious, and he seems to kind of be in control of this life rather than just some drifter who has no clue what's going on at all.
The movie really gives its first good 10 minutes to the process of what it might be like to be homeless.
Yeah.
I mean, it shows him breaking into a house to get a bath. It shows him scrounging for food. You're kind of immersed in his existence.
Yeah, and I think Saulnier sets up these assumptions for us to draw those conclusions, and then he challenges them. And I wonder if that ultimately might be the point of the film, if you need to look for a point, is how easy it is as a person, as a character, to get yourself caught up in a narrative that you've constructed for yourself, that clearly this character has constructed about the way he sees his life going because of his circumstances, and then the consequences of getting caught up in that narrative.
The irony of that and the Chigurh comparison, Adam, is that in a way, he is as effective as Anton Chigurh in this story, not by any skill, not by anything he really does of his own power. In a few instances, you know, he's bit it, if not for something completely outside of his own power. But he's still a force of death.
Yeah.
He brings with him death and destruction everywhere he goes, and the least likely character to do that. So I like that irony of the film, too.
Yeah, and I mentioned the cast. I do want to single out. Sam and I both really loved Kevin Kolak. He plays Teddy. He's the brother of the man that Dwight has gone after. And there is a scene between them in a field, and it has no business being at all funny, and yet it's really entertaining. And not funny in a overly comedic way. It's not necessarily laugh out loud funny, though there are a couple moments that are pretty close in this film. And that tone really is something that Saulnier pulled off here. And I don't really know how he did it, because it is absurd. The whole circumstances that Dwight finds himself in are absurd. And there are those moments where the characters seem to recognize it, but it never detracts from the seriousness overall, the dramatic tone to the film.
You know what, when you say they don't recognize it, they don't recognize that they're in a movie. And I feel like sometimes these deconstructions that you're talking about, Steve, you're aware of that.
Right.
Not only is the director aware of the deconstructions, but the characters seem aware of it too.
Yeah.
That doesn't happen here. I mean, these people just feel like they're stuck in this in real life. And I think that heightens the suspense.
Stay in the trunk.
Well, that's easy. My leg's broke.
Are you coming for me or for her?
Who?
You came to my sister's house. Were you coming for me or for her?
Look, man. You.
Why didn't you just call the police? Send me to jail.
Same as you. Just keeping it in-house.
Blue Ruin, the first film on our Golden Brick shortlist, is currently available via Netflix streaming and for rent via Amazon, Vudu, and Google Play.
In a show devoted to celebrating good stuff, we thought we should throw in a little bad. Massacre Theater is up next. Plus, we'll revisit my interview with John Michael McDonough, writer-director of another Golden Brick candidate, Calvary. Stay with us. Reminder here, folks, that this episode of Film Spotting is brought to you by Shutterstock.com. At Shutterstock.com, you'll find the perfect video for your next creative project.
You've got over 2 million high-quality stock video clips to choose from. Shutterstock ensures you get quality and selection from its video clip libraries. A lot of their contributors are, in fact, professional filmmakers. They add over 20,000 video clips per week.
You can try Shutterstock today by signing up for a free account. Don't need a credit card, just start an account and begin browsing Shutterstock to help imagine what your next project could be like. Save your video selections that you find to your clip box. Once you do decide to purchase, use offer code FILM1114 and new accounts will receive 20% off only footage clips. That's Shutterstock.com, and for 20% off any video clips with a new account, use offer code FILM1114. We thank Shutterstock for their support. Well, you know me. No,
I don't jump for joy. Let's everybody think of one incident where Katniss Everdeen genuinely moved you.
When she volunteered for her sister at the reaping.
Excellent example. Okay. Now, I hope that wasn't important. Okay, volunteer forces. Good. What else?
Oh, when she sang that song for Little Rue.
Oh, yeah. Who didn't get choked up at that?
Mm.
the juggernaut that is The Hunger Games. You're listening to Film Spotting. The Hunger Games Mockingjay Part 1 opened last weekend, and we are planning to get to a review of Katniss Everdeen and Company on next week's show, along with a review of Foxcatcher from Bennett Miller. Before we get to Massacre Theater and a little more Golden Bricks talk on this week's show, we wanted to tell you about the poll question we've got going over at filmspotting.net, with many of you heading out to the multiplex, theoretically with your family. That could happen, right, Josh?
Oh, this weekend? Happens all the time.
And in the weekends to come through the remainder of the holiday season, we're asking you, which holiday Hollywood spectacle are you most likely to see before the end of the year? So nice contrast to this Golden Brick heavy show. These aren't Golden Brick contenders. These are the movies you are going to be hearing a lot about if you haven't already heard a lot about them, and very well may see.
Maybe because your family dragged you to them.
That's really it. It's not about the movie you most want to see, but which one do you think you're actually most likely to
see? Predict your future.
That's right. So the options are
Exodus, Gods and Kings. This is Ridley Scott's Ten Commandments. Christian Bale is playing Moses there. The Hobbit, The Battle of the Five Armies.
Really? That's the best title? I mean, at least it's not The Desolation of Smaug.
When you have five armies battling at them, you want to sell it right up front. Hunger Games, we mentioned. Mockingjay Part 1. Into the Woods, we're including with these films. It's the big screen adaptation of the Stephen Sondheim musical. And then The Interview, possibly you'd go to The Interview with your family, the James Franco, Seth Rogen comedy about their attempt to assassinate Kim Jong-un. I don't know what your family's like, but it's a possibility.
Probably not on the docket with my kids, but
no.
We'll see. We want to know what you think, everybody. Vote now and leave your comments over at filmspotting.net. It is time for a little bit of Massacre Theater. Last time, Josh, you and very special guest host Tasha Robinson from The Dissolve massacred this scene.
And you're Mr. Dundee, does he?
No. He's very reserved. He's a legend. Up here. I mean, there he was out there doing a quiet spot of fishing when all of a sudden, bang, this giant crocodile came up, turned him over, bit half his leg off, dragged him down under. Killed it, of course. I mean, any normal man would have just turned up his toes and died. But not our Mick. No. Hundreds of miles. Snake-infested swamps. On his hands and knees, he crawled right into Catherine.
Straight past the hospital and into the first pub for a beer. That story's getting better every time you tell it, Wally.
That was Maggie Blinko as Ida and John Meehlin as Wally in 1986's Crocodile Dundee. It was written by John Cornell, Ken Shady, and star Paul Hogan. How about that?
How about that?
You know what else I didn't know? Who directed Crocodile Dundee?
No.
Would you like to hear that?
I would love to.
Peter Faman.
The infamous Peter Faman.
The infamous. Tasha and I reviewed the new film, Dear White People, and we shared our top five culture clash comedies, hence the massacre of the definitive culture clash comedy, Crocodile Dundee.
That was a Josh Larson choice through and through.
You think so?
I do. I remember you suggested it, Josh. You can't get out of that one. My thanks to Tasha for filling in for me last week and for giving us such a funny rendition of that scene.
She was excellent.
Let's go ahead and reach into the very not brimming Film Spotting hat. A lot of non-children of the 80s, apparently, they did not recognize Crocodile Dundee.
They just didn't. No one wanted to admit
that could be
that
it.
They recognized
that could
Crocodile
be it.
Dundee.
Reach in, Josh. Pick out this week's winner.
The winner is Sarah Blum. Possibly Bloom, Sarah. Not quite sure, but she's from Chicago.
Congratulations, Sarah. Email feedback at filmspotting.net to claim your very own Film Spotting t-shirt.
I think your dialogue is beautiful. I really do. I love it.
Then why the hell don't you just stand still and say it instead of wandering all over the stage? You're supposed to be looking for your soul, not an ashtray.
We move on now to this week's edition of Massacre Theater, and we considered a few different paths, a few different tie-ins, and we landed on, well, not a very good tie-in in some ways.
Let's just call it a deep cut tie-in.
It's a deep cut because it does tie in with our Golden Bricks. Not this year's Golden Bricks, at least not that we're aware of off the top of our heads, but Golden Brick nominees from years past. And unfortunately, that's not probably going to do a lot of people many good. So I'm going to give an even juicier clue.
Okay.
The star. And this was, I think, really safe to say the breakout performance for
probably
this actor or actress.
Mm-hmm.
And this actor or actress.
When you begin, it will clearly be an actress.
Indeed. Is among the ensemble in Birdman. I'm giving you a clue.
You're
I want some more entries, Josh.
There.
I want some more entries.
Okay. All right.
I'm digging for entries here. It's just the scene really doesn't give anything away. We picked it because we like the scene and we like the dialogue, but there's nothing about it that necessarily says this movie in bright lights on a Broadway marquee.
That's true.
Okay.
I think we should get going before you name the title of the film.
I'm with you. I'm going to start off. You give me the action.
And action.
I was just wondering what your church's stance on lying and adultery was.
It's not a good thing.
Oh, I agree wholeheartedly. But then tell me this. Assuming there is a hell.
Oh, the Christian church recognizes the existence of hell.
Okay, so we'll just say there's a hell.
There is, just so we're clear.
Okay, but for argument's sake.
No, there's no argument. It's there, right below our feet, right above the Orient.
And scene. If you know what scene we just massacred, email the movie's title along with your name and location to feedback@filmspotting.net. Your deadline is Monday, December 8th.
The winner will be selected randomly from all the correct entries and announced on the show in a couple of weeks. To get official Massacre Theater rules, visit filmspotting.net.
I'm going to kill you, Father. I'm going to kill you because you've done nothing wrong. I'm going to kill you because you're innocent. Not right now, though. I'll give you enough time to put your house in order. Make your peace with God.
We get back into our Golden Brick preview with that scene from writer-director John Michael McDonough's Calvary. It features Brendan Gleeson as a rural Irish priest having just about the worst week imaginable.
Calvary, along with Blue Ruin, is the second of our Golden Brick nominees. We'll share the complete shortlist in a bit, but first, we wanted to revisit the interview I did with McDonough back in August. Calvary is McDonough's second film as a director. His first was The Guard, which also starred Gleeson.
Have you spoken to anyone about this?
I'm speaking to you now.
I mean, have you sought professional help?
Why? So I could learn how to cope? So I could learn how to live with it? Maybe I don't want to cope. Maybe I don't want to learn how to live with it.
Why don't you make a formal complaint? You can testify.
The man's dead.
I don't know what to say to you. I have no answer for you, I'm sorry.
Thanks for joining me, John.
Pleased to speak to you.
So your previous film, The Guard, also with Brendan Gleeson, it has a scene involving a confessional as well, though it's less instrumental, I'd say, to the story than the ones in Calvary. And confessionals, they're commonly featured in movies. What do you think it is about that situation, a confessor and a listener boxed in together yet still separated, that appeals to cinematic storytellers?
I think the main thing for me was to give the film a kind of mystery element hook right from the off. I mean, it's a pre-credit sequence, really.
Mm-hmm.
And I think most filmgoers, they may not be familiar with, you know, the tenets of the Catholic religion, but I think they have a basic idea that, you know, a priest in the confessional is like a lawyer, where whatever you tell him, he's not allowed to repeat.
Sure.
So I think people are familiar with that. And I thought, well, that would be a good opening for the movie. I'm a big fan of Hitchcock's film, I Confess, with Montgomery Clift. And the whole idea of, you know, someone being threatened in a confessional, or that you're told something you can't repeat, I thought is just a good way of structuring a film.
Sure.
The specific opening sequence, it's almost like a three-act play in itself, even though it's just, you know, a close-up on a man's face, basically. We're basically getting the entire plot of the movie, and we're getting a kind of masterclass, I guess, from Brendan Gleeson as he's reacting to what's being said. I always feel that, you know, in a pre-credit sequence, you should be setting up the movie, and I can't set up the movie in the way Michael Bay sets his movies up with, you know, explosions, massive CGI and special effects, but I can do it in terms of acting, dialogue, and plot.
I can
attack it that way.
You can do it with a face in this scene, actually.
Hold on a great actor's face and do it that way.
Go ahead.
It was also, I knew I was going to start with the epigraph from St. Augustine.
Mm.
So I knew that would be over black, and I thought this would be interesting for her to have the quotation fade. You remain on black, and then gradually, you know, Brendan's face comes up into the light. There was there's a movie by Bob Rafelson called The King of Marvin Gardens that begins with it begins on black, and then gradually we see Jack Nicholson, and the camera slowly pulls back as Jack Nicholson's telling this anecdote, and we start to realize that he's in a radio studio, and he's like a late night radio host, and he tells this long story of 7 minutes. I always thought it was a really interesting way to start a film, but I didn't want it to last 7 minutes, so I thought, you know, cut it down to two and we'll have a pretty cool pre-credit sequence. So that was the sort of, those are the all ideas that were in my mind before I started writing it.
It seemed to me that was actually almost 4 minutes long, and it is a single take, and really we're held there, as you mentioned, because we have Brendan Gleeson's face, and I don't think it's probably a challenge for him to capture an audience for about 4 minutes. I think he can do that, but still, this was a unique scenario that you did put him in to open the movie this way. What did the two of you talk about in terms of performance to make the scene work?
Well, I mean, we'd had rehearsals. I think we had about 4 or 5 days of rehearsals. We also had a very good actor playing the off-camera part. It was actually...
Who we probably shouldn't identify, right? Because we don't want to...
Well, yeah, but see, the thing is, the actual, you know, the person, the killer it's going to turn out to be, or the man who's threatening to kill, obviously he wasn't there that day on set anyway.
Okay,
so
okay.
So we have a different actor. We had a different actor in the physical space.
That's, you know, what I was going to ask,
you know,
about.
Just because, you know, you want to give Brendan something to work with.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, you know, we didn't really go into it too deeply. I think Brendan has talked a lot about, you know, his performance is all based on instinct, especially in this part. And I think, you know, in this sequence, he's really listening. I mean, it's a great example of an actor listening to another actor and all the reactions that he goes through, you know. I think the other thing is there's a lot of tension to the scene, not only in what's being said and, you know, and the kind of the horror that the person is explaining, but there's a tension in the sense, I think, that the audience is expecting us to cut at some point, you know, and we don't. And I think that makes an audience uneasy, you know, and it's meant to right at the start of the movie. And also you're trying to say, okay, so anybody who saw The Guard, you know, you're not going to get The Guard too. It's going to be a different type of film.
Sure, sure. Yeah, there's a great touch Gleeson has there where he tilts his head back. You mentioned the darkness and the light, and he kind of disappears into the darkness at the height of his disgust about what he hears.
Yeah.
So I did like that touch. So was he actually in a confessional then, or
well,
was this location or set?
It's a structure that's similar to a confessional, but it has to have we had to have enough leeway and, you know, movable parts so we could shift the lighting around as we had to, or shift the camera around until we found the perfect spot. So it is a physical structure. It wouldn't be, you know, to scale as a professional, but he was in a like a box like structure.
Yeah, and the lighting is exquisite. I like that give and take between soft glow and the inky darkness you mentioned.
Yeah, it's funny because I thought it'd be simple to set that up. Larry Smith usually lights very quickly, and that took ages to get right, actually, longer than I was expecting.
You're listening to Film Spotting. I'm Josh Larson talking with writer-director John Michael McDonough about his new film, Calvary, starring Brendan Gleeson. Opening a movie in a confessional is a bit of a bold statement, I think. Right away, you've brought religion into the mix, which is always a wild card. And each audience member, they're going to have their own personal associations, I think, negative and positive, with a confessional scenario, to say nothing of, you know, the religious cliches that movies have dumped upon us. So given that sort of baggage, why did you want to root the movie right at the start that way? You talked about it in terms of structure a little bit, but how about thematically? What was the thinking there?
Well, I guess the main thing is it's a man doing his job. You know, that's the start of it. So he's sitting there, and obviously there's a lot of talk in the film about detachment, and he's there sitting reading a book, Moby Dick. I'm not sure how clear that is in the movie, but all we see is that he's looking down reading something. But so it's kind of it's about a man who's, you know, in his little box, and he's detached, and he's confronted by this horrific thing that has happened to this other human being, and now he has to deal with it. So I guess that, you know, that's what was in my mind. That's this kind of the philosophical idea. It was also getting across sort of the horror of that kind of abuse, but doing it verbally. You know, so he is sitting there listening, but so are we in the audience sitting there listening. You know, mm-hmm. We have to absorb what's been said.
Calvary does feature another confessional scene. That's one where Father James is with his grown daughter, played by Kelly Riley. And they have a complicated relationship, and it's really only in the confessional, I thought, that they have one of their most direct conversations. It also features my favorite Father James line, "God is great, the limits of his mercy have not been set."
Yeah.
How did you decide to frame that scene between father and daughter this way? And is there any way maybe it does relate to the opening confessional scene?
Well, obviously it opens out because now we are going to see Fiona, or played by Kelly Riley. I always loved the kind of the beautiful shot of, you know, through a confessional grate, you know, the way that the shadows play on someone's face.
Mm-hmm.
So I always knew I was going to do, you know, front on and then from the side. I wasn't prepared for how, you know, like beautiful those sorts of shots would play on the big screen. As regards the scene itself, I mean, it's an interesting one because she is obviously pouring out her heart, but she's doing it in a situation where she knows that her father, who is also her father, her priest, cannot break the seal and cannot talk to her outside the confessional. So she's kind of putting him on the spot in a way. So it's kind of an aggressive act on her part. But I think it's a way of her being able to deal with all the issues that they have together, and do it in that, again, going back to this is his job. So it's almost like a therapy session in a way for her, I suppose.
Sure, sure.
And again, he has to sit there and listen to it because it's his job, you know. Whereas a father, obviously, the fact that she had tried to commit suicide, that, you know, you'd be compassionate, Bill. Obviously, it would make you angry, wouldn't it? And so he has to deal with his anger in that scene as well. I mean, I'm very proud of that scene. It was interesting, though, because, you know, I sent Brendan the first draft of the screenplay, and, you know, all the scenes were there mostly. But he wanted me to develop sequences with the daughter to make the film a more emotional film. And actually, that confessional scene wasn't in that draft. I'd been thinking that I needed another confessional scene, and I thought, okay, I can get two things. I can get a confessional scene, and I can open up this relationship, you know. So it kind of solved two purposes. I'm really happy with that sequence, actually.
Well, congratulations on all the acclaim the movie has been getting. And thanks for digging into that opening scene with me. I appreciate the peek into your process.
Thanks, Josh.
Killing a priest on a Sunday. That'll be a good one. Do you not have anything to say to me, Father?
Not right now, no. But I'm sure I'll think of something by Sunday week.
Again, that was John Michael McDonough with Josh back in August of this year. Calvary hasn't come out yet, but if you are eager to see it, especially after that interview, it's scheduled to be released on DVD on December 9th. Again, that's December 9th. It will also be available for digital rental via iTunes and Amazon on that same day.
Calvary and Blue Ruin, that's two Golden Brick candidates so far. If you're keeping score at home, our complete short list of titles is up next. We'll also have our review of Startup, another small movie that came and went fairly quickly this year, but shouldn't be forgotten. Stay with us.
Hold me, stranger, don't deceive. Angel master, can't retreat. Existing to leave. Told you danger, carbon crown. March through the salt slush, howling at the ground. Whistle my answer, dance a blank face. Torment my sugar and leave any trace. Flowering, flowering.
I think the important thing is that, you know, we fought, we made up, We had a nice cuddle. Beautiful day.
Sophie, what are you talking about? We had a fight and you stormed out. We didn't make up.
Baby, are you okay?
I'm fine. Are you okay? I'm
okay, Mr. Hangover. I think it's time for some food. Huh? Let's get something in your stomach.
You're kind of freaking me out a little bit, Sophie. I gotta stop. Is that bacon?
Yeah.
You hate it when I eat bacon.
You'll have to trust us. Things get a whole lot weirder than that. Welcome back to Film Spotting. That was Mark Duplass and Elizabeth Moss in that clip from The One I Love, a movie from first-time director Charlie McDowell. Not a movie we really agreed on much at all, Josh, but we agree it was a movie that wasn't widely seen, and it is a movie that features a first-time director doing some interesting or at least ambitious things.
Yeah, that's for sure.
That does sound like a Film Spotting Golden Brick candidate to me. We'll get to the full list of candidates here. We've been putting it off as long as we could. Here is the short list, the movies that fit all our criteria as we see it for the 2014 Golden Brick Award. Again, underseen or overlooked, reviewed by at least one of us on the show, a new or young filmmaker, and shows distinct vision, some artistic ambition. With that, you've heard Blue Ruin, Calvary. We have a couple others as well that are movies we both talked about on the show and recommended.
Yeah, we're grouping these in a couple different ways here. Here are ones we both recommended. In addition to those, Listen Up, Philip from Alex Ross Perry, Color Wheel director. This stars Jason Schwartzman and Elizabeth Moss. Also, Whiplash from Damien Chazelle, who directed Guy and Madeline on a Park Bench. His film is with Miles Teller and J.K. Simmons.
We also have a couple that are Josh Larson picks only. I have seen one of them. I'm just not as on board with them as you are. That's The Double from Richard Ayoade. He also made Submarine. That was his debut. This movie stars Jesse Eisenberg and Mia Wasikowska. And The Congress, the Ari Folman film, he made The Great Waltz with Bashir. We're both big fans of that. This movie stars Robin Wright. Certainly ambitious. I know that just based on what I know about the film, even though I haven't seen it. You thought it worked.
Yeah, definitely. And if you like the animated aspect, especially of Waltz with Bashir, it's worth seeing The Congress just for those segments of that film. Here are some of Adam's picks, films I need to catch up with or didn't like quite as much as he did. 20,000 Days on Earth. This is the Nick Cave sort of documentary, I guess you could say. Finding Vivian Meyer from John Maloof and Charlie Siskel.
Documentary.
I missed that one, but I did recently see the exhibit of her photographs at the Chicago History Museum. Made me want to check this out even more.
There you go.
Really striking. Locke. This one, yeah. Didn't quite go for this, Adam. I know you really liked it, from Stephen Knight with Tom Hardy and almost a solo show performance
for sure
there. Mistaken for Strangers is the national documentary directed by Tom Berninger. And then The One I Love, which you heard from Charlie McDowell, directing Mark Duplass and Elizabeth Moss again.
So quite a few titles there that fit our criteria. We are going to feature all of those at filmspotting.net on our Golden Brick page. So you can find that. Just click on Top Fives, or you can find a link in the show notes for this episode. And we should mention that we are going to put a lot of stock in the listener's choice here. We may even let the listeners decide.
Yeah, we were talking about that,
is
turning that completely over to listeners.
And that's important to us because it goes back really to the start of the Golden Brick and Moon, which was really the overwhelming choice from our listeners, who said this, and this is kind of that fifth criteria. It was, this is the movie that I never would have seen and ultimately loved or appreciated if it wasn't for Film Spotting. Mm-hmm. So again, underseen, overlooked, and maybe you wouldn't have heard anything about it, or if you did hear something about it, you wouldn't have actually been driven to see if it wasn't for both of us reviewing it favorably, or at least one of us talking about it here on the show and liking it. So we really do want to hear from you. Later, we're going to put up a poll question where we'll get your votes specifically on kind of the finalists. We have to share the finalists later, but this is the short list. And just be thinking about that as you're looking over the list and thinking about the movies that you think are most eligible, most deserving of the Golden Brick. What's the movie or two that maybe it really was because of Film Spotting that you finally saw? With all those finalists, we do have one more to add, Josh. It is the father-son prison drama Startup. It stars Jack O'Connell and the great Ben Mendelsohn. Jack O'Connell is having a heck of a year. He's really, really good in Startup, but he's probably going to become a much more familiar face come Christmas when he stars in the Angelina Jolie-directed Unbroken. That's O'Connell as Olympic runner Louis Zamperini. He was taken prisoner by the Japanese during World War II. We caught up with Startup in September.
Eric Love, 19, with Startup on.
I'm gonna tell you something, all right?
This is no young offender's turn now.
You have to behave. Because I will kill you. Kids causing issues. You know what's necessary.
In case you haven't fully appreciated, I am his father.
Except for that time you and I got a little crazy on the Ferris wheel outside WBEZ Studios here, Adam. Remember, we had to spend some time in the Navy Pier brig. Neither of us has had a lot of experience with correctional facilities. So I'm guessing you watched Startup similarly to the way I did, with a mixture of morbid curiosity and an unmanly level of fear.
Mm-hmm.
What would it be like to find yourself locked up in one of these places? Along those lines, Startup has a claustrophobic initiation scene. Eric Love, played by Jack O'Connell, is a youth offender in the British prison system who's been starred up, sent ahead of schedule to an adult facility. The movie opens by clinically capturing his admittance process. He's issued a series of rough commands. He's marched through an endless maze of gates and doors. Through it all, Eric maintains a veneer of tough guy composure and purposeful nonchalance. But I think we do catch a wince of vulnerability flicker across his face when he's ordered to squat as part of the contraband check. Eventually, he's ushered to his cell where the door is slammed shut. He drops his guard and lets free an expression of self-disgust, it seemed to me. Notice how quickly he glances past the mirror that's in the cell. Then he gets to the business of creating a shiv and hiding it in the ceiling. At this point, we're left alone with him, and I'm curious what you felt right there in Startup's opening scenes. Were you afraid for Eric or afraid of him? And did those feelings change by the film's end?
It is true that that opening initiation, as you put it, is pretty benign. When he comes in, there's a real procedural sense to it. He doesn't ever lose his cool or act threatening. The guards don't ever lose their cool or act threatening with him. But I was probably more afraid of him just based on having read the plot description in the video when I ordered it on demand. Couldn't really look away from it. And it says this: condemned to an adult prison, an explosively violent young man must fight for survival against criminal forces. Help comes from the unlikeliest source, his estranged father.
Played by Ben Mendelsohn.
Yeah, and Ben Mendelsohn, we'll get to that. I'm not sure that line is accurate, as plot descriptions sometimes aren't.
Probably not, yeah.
But that first line, just having that in my head, there's nothing really to base a perception of him on as he walks in. It's wordless for the first 10 or 15 minutes. It's just a lot of physical action. I think you put it well, purposeful, nonchalant. So it's hard to read. If I didn't know that line, explosively violent young man, I probably wouldn't really have had any sense of him whatsoever. We don't know at that point that he's been starred up or what that even means. We just know that he looks a little bit young and he is coming in to this new prison. But knowing that he's explosively violent, trusting that, I was waiting for him to explode. And it doesn't take too long for him to unleash a beating on someone. I think it's the first time we really see violence in the movie. It's the guy across the hall. And it's fitting, I think, that it's completely based on a misunderstanding. Not that the force he uses could be justified, but it's a legitimate reaction in the moment that he does regret when he learns what the true circumstances were. And I think that's how most of the violence in this place in life occurs, because of misunderstandings or confrontational moments that just push past the point of no return for these men. And I think there is a huge part of the suspense of this movie is knowing that violence can erupt at any moment just based on that slightest misunderstanding or just one word that someone takes the wrong way. By the end, I was definitely more afraid for him. And it's not just because of the danger lurking every day in that prison that we see, danger that will likely find you no matter how much you try to hide from it, but because I did certainly feel sympathy for him. There is a lot we learn that's been stacked against this kid from the start. And there is a certain sense of justice too, Josh, that accompanies most of his actions. You don't get the sense he takes particular pleasure in doling out these beatings. And we do learn that the crime he's actually in prison for fits this notion of justice. It's just the nature of the world he lives in, and he has to act accordingly. There's even kind of a Fight Club idea where the only way he seems to feel anything is to feel pain. And I think once you sort of tap into that, obviously he's not someone you would feel comfortable spending a lot of time with, but you do see that humanity in him. You see that he is the product of his environment. And because of that, definitely by the end of the film, I felt that empathy and that sympathy for him and wasn't fearful of him at all.
I'm glad you mentioned regret, because you're right. That's definitely something he expresses after that initial beating, and he finds out what he thought was going to take place didn't. It was sort of a defensive posture, a defensive action he takes to the extreme, because we learn that is maybe his nature. Maybe that's how he's had to survive. The fact that he expresses that regret, and even more than that, he tries to make amends for it in a completely naive way. He tries to convince the warden, or perhaps it's one of the head guards at that point, that it was a misunderstanding, and he thinks he can explain his way out of it. And that, to me, speaks to the fact that he is, to some degree, a kid.
Yeah.
Even though he's obviously experienced by making that shiv, it's an immediate reaction. Mm-hmm. Okay, this is what I've got to do. I'm here, get my defensive weapons that I can and prepare for what's coming. So you know he's an experienced kid, but yet there's somewhere in there that naivete of this can be made right, perhaps, in some way.
He at least tries.
He tries, and there's something so tragic about that. So my answer to the question about if I feared for him or was afraid of him is, from that very beginning, both. And I think this is a real mark of this film, that they're able to pull this off. The writer is Jonathan Asser, and it's directed by David McKenzie. They're able to realize that this kid is, to some degree, a menace, a menace to society, for sure. He has that capability. But they never lose sight of his humanity. And it's not even something that I, at least, came to realize towards the end. Some films will do that. Well, finally, they'll get you to see the other side of person. It's something that's held in its hands both sides at once throughout the film,
yeah,
which I think is a pretty impressive achievement.
No, I think you're absolutely right. And I also want to credit the director, McKenzie, and the DP, Michael McDonough, who also shot Winter's Bone.
Right.
And I think they really effectively draw out, use the word claustrophobic, I think. There is a sense of claustrophobia that you would expect in a prison, but it's heightened here without them really having to dig into any sort of bag of tricks to give you that sense. There's not any real playing with the depth of field where it's really shallow and you only see the characters right in front of you, or only relying on really close, tight shots. We do follow these characters in this space, but the space is just so cramped. It's so linear, and it's always shooting these vertical rooms, the cells, or these vertical hallways. And so there really is this sense of these characters just stuck and, again, trying to explode, because what else can they do but try to burst out of these walls? And they also don't go for what you might expect, and we've seen in other prison dramas, where you can go that harsh antiseptic look where it's all kind of white or it's all shades of gray. There's color here, but it's all mostly a brownish yellow.
It's monotonous.
That isn't in any way happy or inviting.
No, no. I'm glad you mentioned the cinematography, because I think it is a hallmark of the film. Overall, the production is very minimalist. There's not a lot of dialogue. Not much of it can you understand if you're not familiar with the dialect being used in the film. So it's very much a movie of gestures, physical action, confined spaces, minimalist sound design. And yet, despite that, that makes it sound like, and it did remind me at many points of a Dardenne Brothers film. They often will shoot from behind one of the characters as they're walking.
They follow this guy. Following I thought of someone. That as well. You're right.
So I think that is a trait. But then there are these little breakaways where the cinematography doesn't get show-offy, but it allows something else to enter the picture. And they set this up in that almost every scene of a claustrophobic room also somewhere has a window in it, in this facility, and there's light coming through the window, and that comes into play later on. There's a payoff in a couple of moments where Eric is alone in his cell, and the first one I think of is, I believe he's smoking and he's blowing rings into the sunshine that's coming through that window, and it's a reverie moment. It's a quiet moment of respite that's a break from everything else. There's another one where he's leaping. I forget if he's jumping rope or he's leaping into the air, and he blocks the sunlight. We see his silhouette. And these are almost something like from a Malick film all of a sudden. And I just liked that contrast where it is predominantly minimalist and oppressive and claustrophobic, but we do get these little breathing spaces that speak to another side of Eric, his character, I think, and speak to another side of the world, the possibility of another world, at least.
If you comply with the regime, I'm prepared to offer you a place back on the wing and a special kind of therapy with Mr. Baumer, with whom you cooperated upstairs. But one more incident of any kind that comes to my attention, you'll be straight back down here.
Just one problem.
You're going to tell me what that is?
I'm just saying. Say this therapy goes well, and it changes my life, and I rehabilitate. And then you lay it on for the next geezer, and it works for him, and the next. And everything's sweet, yeah? Crime rates start to come down, police got less people to nick, court's got less people to convict. Pretty soon, you're out of a job.
You're listening to Film Spotting. We're discussing the new UK prison drama Startup. I didn't think about Malik in any of those shots, but it's funny you bring him up because the same thing he's seeking, I think, with a lot of his visuals is the same thing we get here, not just maybe a sense of respite, but this idea of transcendence, mm-hmm. that there is something outside these walls. There is something outside the confines of these characters' heads, even, that they can aspire to. And it could have just been this gritty, bleak, hard, violent drama. And it's all of those things.
I think it predominantly is
just that.
Right.
And you're right. It finds ways to transcend that and give us this concept of transcendence. The language is something to talk about as well. And maybe for people who are listening and thinking of seeking this movie out, they can take a cue from us one way or another here, because this is the first time I've ever paid twice to watch a movie once.
So that you could watch it with subtitles?
I started watching it on demand. It was available via cable on demand. So, of course, I'm going to choose my TV versus my laptop or plugging my laptop into the TV.
Right.
Why don't I just go ahead and watch it on that TV? So that's what I did. And I got about 20 minutes into it. And I was having such a hard time making out what they were saying,
mm-hmm.
just because of the nature of the language, the way they speak, but also because they're often using slang. The title is a slang term, Startup. That gives you a cue that the film is filled with this type of language. And I really found myself so lost. Now, of course, this movie is one where a lot of it is so physical. And as you said, there's a lot of silence to it as well. So it's not as if you can't get a sense of what's going on from the characters' faces and their actions. You can. But I also think the words are so important, because as we see throughout the film, it is those certain words that can start this explosion of violence. So I wanted to know what these characters were saying and really what they meant when they were saying things to each other. And I did get to about the 25-minute mark, and I said, I wonder if I buy this on iTunes, if I can turn on the subtitles. And sure enough,
okay.
I could. And I watched the rest of the film with the subtitles on. And not only that, with my laptop next to me so that I could pause the movie and go to Urban Dictionary. I did, and look up some of the terms, some of the words that they use, because otherwise I really do feel like I would have had a lesser experience. Not that I would have been lost necessarily, but somehow my experience would have been diminished. And I actually did read somewhere today a little snippet that apparently, not surprisingly, this has been brought up to the filmmakers. Obviously, they thought about the fact that a lot of us Americans would probably lose some of this stuff in translation, and they made the decision to not do any subtitles, not even in those moments where it's the toughest to understand them, which you'll see movies do sometimes.
Right.
They won't use them throughout the film, but in certain moments they will. They made an aesthetic choice. They thought that would somehow ruin the experience. And I get that and I respect that, but I also don't feel bad for a second about watching it with subtitles on.
I probably would have selected that as an option right away if I had had it. So I agree you might want to go that way. Yet I'll also go back to the degree of austerity to this film, mm-hmm. and the way dialogue works. I was pretty lost those first 20 minutes as well, but you get your bearings, and in a way, it's not so much the words that are spoken, but how they're spoken,
right.
or who's speaking them to who. And in a sense, that is something you detect more if you're not worrying about the actual meanings of the words themselves. So I did feel like I got my bearing enough eventually that I could follow that. And mm-hmm. I also think here's maybe where we can get into O'Connell's really impressive performance, because it is so physical. We talked about how he communicates a number of things in that opening scene. And really, it's a performance to me that was built on a series of tells, you could almost think of them as, because he's always putting on one, maybe two fronts, and then there's what he's thinking underneath. And it's just really impressive that an actor of his age is able to pull all of that off. We know that he has this bravado. We know that he has this rage. We've seen it erupt, and we know it can come out at any moment. But then there's that kid underneath, the one he's desperately trying to hide. And it's fascinating to watch him play all those levels at once, which I think he does in just about every scene. There's even a confession scene of a sort where he talks about how he ended up here or what his life was like before. And I'm not even sure I bought everything he was selling in that scene, even though it's supposed to be him burying his soul as much as he can. I partly wondered, is he playing another card here? And I think that's because his performance is so good.
Yeah, I'm with you completely on the performance by Jack O'Connell. And if you haven't seen the movie and maybe trying to visualize him in your head, I've got it perfectly for you. He's the love child of Channing Tatum and Anton Yelchin.
Yes, Anton Yelchin, exactly. There are photos of him where he's closely shaven his hair in this movie, but there's photos of him, press photos, with a lot more hair. Exactly.
Yeah, he's got that kind of kid-like face to him the way Yelchin does, but at the same time, he's bigger and a little more beefy. I know you don't like your men beefy. Or is that me that doesn't like my men beefy?
I forget.
I'm trying to remember that conversation we had several shows ago. It was me who doesn't like him beefy.
You
like
don't like
Tatum.
Him beefy. Yeah, he's not I don't quite, think I'm big on the beefy either.
He's not quite Tatum-esque, but he is a character. You're right. This dance he has to do where he's someone who doesn't belong on the outside. You get the sense watching him that he is a menace in some ways, or we aren't probably safer with him walking around our streets, but he certainly doesn't deserve to be in this hellhole either. And I think that that comes through in the performance, where there's a completely unforced charm about him. He's never too naive and innocent, too childish, but he's never so hardened that that human side doesn't come through. I suppose you would call that a vulnerability. But sometimes when I think of vulnerability, we actually talked about this a little bit last week with our fall preview and James Gandolfini and Tom Hardy.
Right.
These are guys who are big, beefy men, and they can be really masculine and hard, but they're not afraid to completely break down or really show you a certain fragility. I don't know that you ever get a sense of fragility to Jack O'Connell, but just enough vulnerability peeking through to make him, as we've used this word now so many times, to make him human. And I think that there is, with all that said, as good as the performance is and the tells, I think there's so much subtlety to that. You're right, Josh. There is nevertheless a certain thrill I think you have to cop to in just watching him physically be this caged animal. When he's in that cell and he knows that they're coming in after him, there's no talking his way out of it. And at this point, he doesn't even really probably want to talk his way out of it.
No, this is the scene where he's oiling himself up,
right?
He's getting ready for the guards.
He's getting himself ready, and he knows, as he calls them, the goons are going to attack. So you know what? He's going to embrace the attack, and he's at least going to go down swinging. And as I said, maybe it's the only way he's going to feel anything anyway. This is all he really knows, and that all comes through in his performance.
And speaking of Hardy, that's the Bronson aesthetic, right?
Right.
A film I like very much.
I do too.
But that almost gives you that side of a character, full force, full bore. That's pretty much all you get. Again, I like the film quite a bit, but only because it zeroes in on this madness in its entirety and embraces it.
Mm-hmm.
And Hardy gives a performance, a shocking, really terrifying performance.
He does.
I don't know that that's a guy that you ever feel like maybe there's some other something there.
No.
It's been a while since I've seen the film, and maybe I'm not giving it enough credit on that score. But the distinction between the two pictures, because I think there will be a lot of comparisons, not only in the films, but in the performances, is that this movie does offer you that other little glimmer, which I really appreciated.
I do too. And I think maybe more similar to the Bronson character is the actor playing his father, playing Jack O'Connell's father, that is Ben Mendelsohn here. And he certainly doesn't have the stature. He's not physically imposing the way that Tom Hardy is or even Jack O'Connell is. But that's
always
kind
the threat of
the brilliance.
Of
that's the brilliance of Ben Mendelsohn as an actor. And I've certainly been a fan of his since seeing him first in Animal Kingdom, where he's subtle there, but he's a complete psycho. He is evil.
He's probably the smallest guy of all those thugs, but the scariest, right?
Yeah, he absolutely is. And he isn't that evil here, but he is often as scary. And I just love the way Mendelsohn is able to be intimidating. It's through, first, just these dead eyes. You know, there's always this notion that he's looking right through you. He's either unable or unwilling to empathize with anyone that he's speaking to, or he's somehow peering into your soul. He knows a lot more about you than you're willing to let on. It's also, though, the way he moves his whole body. There's a kind of rigidity to it, but he swings his arms out to the side as he walks a little bit, as if he's almost a machine. He doesn't really care who is in his way. He owns that hallway. He owns this room. He owns that field. There will, at any moment, he is in complete control. And that is scary. And that does allow him to be physically imposing to people who are actually much bigger than him. It takes me back to our show last week as well, where I spoke with Dan Schechter, the writer-director of the Elmore Leonard adaptation Life of Crime. We brought up John Hawks in that movie. John Hawks is a guy in a movie like Winter's Bone that can be the smallest guy on screen, but be the scariest person you've ever seen in a movie. And then he can shift to a movie like Life of Crime or the movie he made with Helen Hunt. I'm blanking on the title of that film, where he can be the sweetest, most harmless man in the world. You kind of get that with Mendelsohn a little bit as well. Look at something like The Place Beyond the Pines with Ryan Gosling, where Mendelsohn is a criminal, but just in certain subtle physical shifts and mannerisms, he is a completely different person on screen and can be the complete opposite of a really scary figure like Neville, the dad, here in this movie.
What's going on?
I'm sorry.
You have to help him, you know. You have to teach him the answers, the things that he's supposed to say, you know, like the Think Right program. You know, help him get out. You know, like the what would you do if you're in a bar and a fella comes up and starts talking to your bird, what are you going to do? Oh, I'm going to tell him politely that I'm with her, you know, rather than a glass of cunt. You know what I mean? Exactly. At bollocks.
Okay, that's not what my group is about. Your son and I are on a journey together, and we will...
No, he needs to behave.
Okay, he suffered enormous emotional trauma and abuse.
Oh, I never touched him.
Well, you weren't there.
I didn't. Okay, that's enough. All right.
When Mendelsohn is looking at somebody, they're not human. To him, they're an obstacle or they're a tool. And what's interesting about the way Startup uses that quality is when you bring his son into the mix, that throws off those calibrations a little bit, because now here is someone clearly an estranged son, but still his son, and you're not quite sure if the affection that he shows or the discipline, he really shows more discipline than anything that he shows, is out of a fatherly instinct or is it out of a mercenary instinct? Mm-hmm. Is his son just another tool for playing the power games that go on in this hall? So that dynamic really adds a lot to the film. I'm curious what you make of another dynamic. A whole aspect of this picture is the class. Well, they don't like to call it a class.
But it's therapy.
They call it a meeting.
Yeah,
it's
I'm really glad you went here, because we have to talk about it.
And initially it starts because Eric, during one of his outbursts, gets a guard, let's just say pinned, in a difficult situation.
Yeah.
And this happens in the midst of one of these therapy classes. Eric isn't a member of the class yet. The action kind of spills into one. And the counselor, who's played by Rupert Friend, his name is Oliver, the character's name, stands up and he's able to somehow diffuse it simply by using a different tone towards Eric. And after that, Eric ends up joining this class a little bit reluctantly. There's some more manipulations that go on behind the scenes to get him there. And that becomes a central point of the movie. How did that work for you?
That scene or that
overall thread?
No, it really worked for me because it never devolves into what you sort of fear it might devolve into, which is, as much as I like these films, I did sort of cynically keep waiting for it to become Ordinary People or Good Will Hunting, where the therapist is going to get the character to break down and have a breakthrough and he's going to forgive himself and it's just going to be this
Inspirational teacher cliche.
Yeah, shiny happy moment where exactly right, like we've seen in so many movies. And this movie is smart enough to know that some of these wounds just probably aren't ever going to be healed. And these characters aren't going to be changed forever, and these problems all aren't going to be solved. Even if he makes progress, which I do think we see him make, there's a sense of hope to that, but never this idea, I think, maybe to me anyway, I think it's one of the questions you can ask about this film when it's over is, do you think Eric is ever maybe going to be a productive member of society? Can those wounds be not healed, but can they be salved enough that he might end up getting out of here and doing something with his life? And that makes me think of characters that I mentioned, like Conrad in Ordinary People and Will in Good Will Hunting. Even a character like Will coming from a similar background and having some of the same problems growing up. those characters both have a lot more options in life than someone like Eric does. So even if he gets out of here, whether it's him staying in prison for however many more years or him getting out of here, there are always going to be people trying to provoke him. And is he ever really going to be able to live in that world and not respond to that provocation? I don't know, but it's still very intriguing to watch him make some progress.
I think it does flirt a little with some of those cliches
in
certain scenes, but it backs off just in time and just at the right time. And usually, interestingly, it explodes them in the middle of one of the therapy sessions because they do make incremental progress. And just before you think these guys are going to go into a group hug, going back to the language, something will be said as an aside and the whole room just erupts.
Mm-hmm.
And those scenes are so well handled and choreographed because the counselor, Oliver, he is outmatched here. I mean, just about everybody in the room is bigger than him and certainly more violent than him. And all he does is stand up along with everyone else. And at least in the scene I'm thinking of, he looks down.
Yeah.
And he's just, but what he is he's there.
He is there.
He's not.
Often between them.
Often between them, but not in an aggressive referee way.
No.
He hasn't abandoned them and left the room. He's not disciplining them, but he's there waiting for that little glimmer of their better selves that he's been helping them to find to show up, hoping for his very life that they show up, really, because the situation is so dangerous. And I think that speaks to the larger question that the movie is interested in. Some people might think, and if you lock onto the group therapy narrative, that the most important question is, can this kid become a more productive member of society? And I think the movie is actually interested in something deeper that doesn't matter where he ends up in 10 years, whether it's inside or out.
Yeah.
It's asking the question, does this kid matter?
Right.
Does any of these people in here matter, or should they just be left to their own base impulses and tear each other apart? And so that's why I think Startup is really after a lot bigger things than just your average prison drama.
I agree. And I think you're dead on in the way you describe what you like about those scenes with Oliver, because you almost can't imagine him standing there any longer, but he never does get aggressive. And it's because I think he recognizes that he has to let them come to these conclusions on their own. If he's just another authority figure saying, stop doing this, don't you see this, you can be better than this, it's not going to be effective. They have to realize it on their own. And so he does kind of stay out of that. Now, if I'm being really, really picky, Josh, with this notion of sentimentality and how the movie comes right up against it but doesn't really go past it, there is a moment at the end of the film, not spoiling anything, but I love it. I love everything emotionally, psychologically,
between
the moment
father
suggests.
And son?
There
Can
is
I
a father
that?
And son,
That's
yes.
What you're talking
there is
about.
A father and son moment.
Beautifully handled.
That is beautiful, but there is a line of dialogue I don't think we needed. I don't think we needed that line of dialogue to
between
punctuate
them?
It. Yeah, between them. Yeah.
Did the subtitles give you that?
I don't think so, because it's pretty blatant.
My memory is that we don't hear or understand what they're saying, which is exactly what I liked about it.
No, we'll have to discuss it off air. Maybe, but I really thought it was clear he wasn't very mumbly with the way he expressed that at all.
I read it as a lost in translation moment. I did. Maybe I was completely
He's not whispering it,
not
though, in that
attention.
Moment or anything.
Okay.
But,
now okay. I want to revisit that.
He suffered enormous emotional trauma.
It's not always possible for you to be here to protect him.
Startup is available for digital rental via Amazon, Vudu, and Google Play. You have my permission to turn on the subtitles.
I did that.
I didn't go that way. Adam did.
Yeah.
It probably would have helped me a little bit. I don't think it's necessary, but you might want to make that choice.
Yeah, it's necessary if you want to understand everything they're saying, whether or not you need that to appreciate the movie. Obviously not, Josh. You really appreciated it without following every little bit of dialogue. But really good film there, and we have a lot of good Golden Brick candidates for you. We really do want your feedback on those. Share it with us on Facebook, facebook.com/filmspotting. Share it with us via Twitter. And of course, you can send us an email, feedback@filmspotting.net. We're going to take your responses and kind of go through the list ourselves, and we're going to carve that down to 5 or 6 finalists, and we're going to give you guys a vote here in a couple weeks on the show. Opening in wide release this weekend, a movie that I'm going to say not really eligible for a Golden Brick, Horrible Bosses 2.
Probably nothing with a 2 in the title will ever be eligible for.
I wonder if that will ever happen. Jason Bateman, Charlie Day, Jason Sudeikis in that one. And The Penguins of Madagascar opening as well. In limited release, playing here at the Gene Siskel Film Center in Chicago, Happy Valley. This is a documentary about the Penn State community in the wake of Coach Jerry Sandusky's conviction on child molestation charges. And I have to admit, didn't know anything about this movie. I saw the title. I knew it was coming out. Mm-hmm. Really didn't have any thoughts about it. And then I see here in our notes from the Tillman story and My Kid Could Paint That director, Amir Bar-Lev. That makes me very curious to see it. Yeah, a fan of both of those films and have had some previous interaction with Amir Bar-Lev here on the show. He's heard a couple episodes and that was good. So I'd like to catch up with him at some point. Next week on the show, even though they've been out a little while, we are hoping to get to a discussion of the new film Foxcatcher, starring Steve Carell, Channing Tatum, and Mark Ruffalo, and The Hunger Games: Mockingjay Part 1, since I am finally on board after catching fire with this series. We'll see if it can keep its momentum with Mockingjay. And it's a possibility we're going to do a quick holiday movie preview, focus on some of the films that we're really excited about that maybe aren't the big budget Mockingjay type films coming out over the next month or so. But that is to be determined. If you've got a great top five list for us, as always, we are happy to consider it. Feedback at filmspotting.net.
Film Spotting is produced by Golden Joe Dassault and Sam Van Halgren. Without Sam and Golden Joe, this show wouldn't go. Thanks to associate producer Candace Griffiths and the listeners of the Film Spotting Advisory Board. And special thanks to everyone at Chicago Public Media. Chicago Public Media creates award-winning content about the issues that affect our community, our nation, and our world. More information is available at chicagopublicmedia.org. Our music this week is from Tweety. That's Wilco's Jeff Tweety and Tweety's son Spencer. It comes from their album Suki Ray. More information is at wilcoworld.net. For Film Spotting, I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.